You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome back to Almost Famous Minute, where we're discussing the 2000 Cameron Crowe film, Almost Famous, 1 minute at a time. I'm Eric Nash from Feels Like Weezer.
And I'm using the AKG mic we received recently for the second time, I think, here. Last week's, I think, sounded pretty good. Any listeners certainly can let us know if you find that there's any kind of audio quality issue. Good or bad, just let us know, and we'll see what we can do. But I really appreciate the AKG for handing out mics to a lot of us in our Pantheon podcast network.
And I'm Condra from the Amateur Nerds.
And I, today, am Christian Swain, CEO and president of Pantheon Media, host of Rock and Roll Archaeology, Deeper Digs, and partial host of The Rock and Roll Librarian, all found on Pantheon Podcasts.
At pantheonpodcast.com.
Thank you, Eric.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for coming on, Christian. It's I've actually talked with you a couple times before, you know, via video chat and different things like that. When I joined the network, and a couple times after, probably, you know, for our little inner network,
our soirees, as we like to call them around, you know, here. Yes. Yeah. And I'm excited to be on the show, Almost Famous Minute by Minute. I've never done a minute by minute show before, so I'm excited to see how this whole thing works. Of course, I know the film, and it's one of my favorites, and certainly, you know, one that we hold dear around here in the rock and roll world.
Yeah. Yeah, I imagine it would have been a tougher sell
to get on the network.
That Cameron Crowe, he's a jerk. He doesn't know anything.
Nah, we love and respect Cameron around here.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. And Condra is a returning co-host. I think she probably initially might have been a guest for her first week back when I was doing that. But she's co-hosted since then.
Oh, I'm the virginal sacrifice. I see.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You get the guessing duties, and if you are able to come back further down the road, you might become the co-host, too.
We'll see how it happens. We'll see how I do today.
I might even have been a co-host from the very beginning, because I remember my first one, there was someone who had never podcasted before, because I'd already done Movies by Minute. That
could be. Well, thank you both so much.
Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, it's an interesting subgenre in the podcast world.
Oh, yeah. When it was created between a couple different podcasts, essentially, kind of came up with the idea pretty close to each other without knowing about each other, I'm awfully sure. Star Wars Minute is the one that we're kind of more aligned with because they did daily, and many of the others that immediately followed tried to do daily as well, and or even something like I did through the 3 day a week. But the other one was for the Big Lebowski, what was that one called? And they still put out episodes, even though they're done with the movie, just talking about whatever, I believe, is my understanding.
Oh, that's so nice. Yeah.
So they're not really talking about the Big Lebowski anymore. They're just talking about stuff in general.
Dudism
in general. Are they developing a religion? Is that what
they are? Dudists. Well, that's actually my my current pastor at the church I attend. She is a Dudist follower.
Oh, this is a real thing. Yeah. So she has Apostafarians.
Right.
Okay, get it.
Pretty much. So this is week 59, the way I'm doing it now, and minute 79, and it starts with William looking back at the bus and ends with the road managers playing poker or some such kind of game.
I'm pretty sure
I remember once or twice, probably in college, putting some cards on my forehead, trying to play some kind of game.
Well, isn't there a guessing game with the phones nowadays that's very similar?
Oh, you
stick it on your forehead.
I have done that too.
Yeah, so. So I guess this is where it precurses is the 52 deck version.
Yep.
Interesting. Yeah. So I guess he leaves the bus for the plane. So here's a question. I know Voodoo Child's playing in the background, and then they crossfade into Clarence Carter's Slip Away. But as the plane, they go one last shot of the old decrepit bus, and the plane flies above it. You think that's an homage to Casablanca?
Oh. Wow. I hadn't thought about that, yeah.
I just thought that was kind of an interesting shot. And as we know in movie making, nothing, and I mean nothing, is left to chance, as much as they humanly possibly can do. So everything is considered and thought of, you know, and obviously, you know, to get the angle of the plane, you know, they probably had to do that shot several times. So it was very intentional.
Yeah. And I would say too, that they might have, they might have even repositioned the bus from that previous shot where he's looking back. You see his.
It is in a different position, right?
The way the pavement cement looks, and the little bit of grass coming through cracks.
Right.
Doesn't quite look the same.
Right. So the minute 78 is, I'm sure Voodoo Child is playing in that as we move into 79. Remind me of minute 78.
Well, minute 78, they were starting this walk, but, you know, that's when it's when they're start, when you see them coming out of the bus and they're starting to walk is when the song starts as well. But even before that, it was the end of the scene with Jimmy Fallon
getting the manager gig over Dick.
Yeah, and that's the part talking about Mick Jagger as well. The very very most famous part of I think that I have like three or four very quotable things. I think he says the one. Do you think Mick Jagger will be up on stage at age 50 years old?
Well, we know the answer to that now, don't we?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the last one of the last concerts I saw before pandemic land. We did get to catch the Stones last year, I guess it's New Year's Eve that we're recording this, so it depends on when this comes out, but you know, late 2019. The last show that I did see was a band called The Struts. Very 70s-ish band. Oh, you like the Struts, Condra?
I work at a couple of concert venues, and they opened a few years ago, and they were so good. I hadn't heard of them before they opened for, I don't even remember who it was, but oh my gosh, yes, I really like the Struts. They have such a cool sound to them.
Yeah, it fits very well in our discussion today. They've got that classic rock sound down, you know, a little Queen influence, a little Rolling Stones influence, and their lead vocalist, Luke Spiller, incorporates inhabits a bit of both those gentlemen in his stage persona.
Wow, I'm gonna have to check them out. You both enjoy. Yeah. So
I've seen them six times. So my wife is a huge fan of the Struts. So I have no problem going there. They've been great every single time I've seen them.
Yeah.
So then we switch over to Clarence Carter's "Slip Away." Mm-hmm. You guys familiar with the song?
Besides this movie, I don't know that I've ever heard it anywhere else, or even him. I don't know what else has he done.
I'm sorry, Condra, yourself?
I'm kind of in the same boat as Eric. I don't.
So, you know, Clarence, a blues player, blind from birth, actually I think started off as a duo, if I remember right. Didn't really get anywhere until he went solo. He got hooked up with Rick Hall from Fame Studios, and if you listen to the tune, it's got that real sort of you know, Muscle Shoals meets Stax, Memphis sound. Lots of horns going on in that. But probably the most famous thing that you both may remember, Clarence Carter, he wrote a song called "Tell Daddy" in 1966. Does that ring a bell to anybody?
Oh, tell Daddy. Okay, no.
Does it remind you of another song?
I see it here.
So yes, "Tell Daddy" was the original version.
That sounds more familiar.
Yeah, Etta James's "Tell Mama," which most people are familiar with, is what's called a response song or a callback song. So it's Etta James saying, "Oh, you think it's about Daddy? Well, I'm going to tell it. You know, it's going to be about Mama." And of course, the songs sound very much the same. And Clarence Carter does get writing credit on the Etta James version. Both were cut at Fame Studio and Muscle Shoals.
And I guess that I see here Janis Joplin. So that might be where I've probably heard at least part of the song.
Yep.
It's in my head a little bit.
Yeah, her version as well. Yeah, yeah. And of course, it's been re-recorded a million times as well.
Well, and the big thing for this Slip Away that I noticed was that Greg Allman put out a single in '88 of it.
Oh, he did a cover version of it as well.
Yeah.
Ah, that's
of Slip Away.
Slip Away, not Tell Daddy or Tell Mama. Right. But maybe that's Cameron. Again, making an homage to one of his heroes, of course, as we know, almost famous. The through line is the original story of Cameron going on the road at 15 with the Allman Brothers under the guise of working for Rolling Stone.
Oh yeah! Oh yeah!
Yeah.
I mean, that's mostly I mean, I have my segment of the four bands that mostly make up, and I mean, there's certainly definitely reasons I've come to realize that the Allman Brothers are definitely part of that
of Stillwater,
a big part.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, of making up Stillwater, and a lot because I Greg, not Dwayne, Greg, is much more in line with Russell's character. I believe.
Yeah.
I mean, especially like I mean, his episode with at the house with the acid, you know, that kind of paranoia and stuff that he has that morning, you know, especially.
Right, and of course, who did say I am a golden god?
It's Plant, right?
Oh yeah, Robert Plant. Yeah. Do you know how that actually came about?
I bet I heard, but I just cannot recall it right now. So go ahead.
So Cameron really wanted to use a Zeppelin song. I forget which song it was. If not, a couple. There's probably a couple Zeppelin songs. In fact, I think there are three. But to get permission, he had to show Robert and Jimmy a cut of the movie.
Yeah.
So he went to England, you know, rented a small, studio theater, and the guys came in, and he's sitting in the back watching them nervously, waiting to see if they were going to grant him permission. And when it came to that scene, Robert stood up, turned around and said, "I fucking said that." And he knew at that point they were going to get the songs.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's a great story, and one of those rock and roll stories you love to hear about.
So, like the chances of not getting the some songs from Zeppelin into the movie, you know, hinged on Cameron's choice
of
putting that scene
or
in
or how Robert was going to take it.
He could have taken it more poorly.
And I think we might all agree that certainly from about 1969 till 1976, 78 or so, Robert Plant was definitely a golden god.
Conjure, was there something you wanted to?
Yeah, I was just thinking about all of these different stories. I think that's why this movie is so special to do for like a Movies by Minute, because you just have these opportunities to like really dive in and like consider like what is this in really reference to, and it's kind of cool how much like this is kind of like in a very weird way, like a love letter to a past experience, and like a love letter to early, like, 70s rock and roll in a lot of ways, like late 60s, early 70s rock and roll. Like, it's so, it's very brutally honest about a lot of the unpleasant parts. Case in point, the second half of this minute and next minute. But at the same time, it really, like, it has all of this fun history built in that makes it a lot of fun to talk about and, like, really give some, like, some good opportunities for cool things to learn.
Oh, there's layers and layers in this film. And to your point, yeah, Cameron is definitely writing a love letter to his youth, him coming into the business. It is firmly planted in the 70s. If I can throw my musicologist hat on for a moment, it is definitely the early 1970s. The whole look and feel, the cultural signifiers, the touchstones that he hits on, all the Easter eggs. It's definitely hearkening back to that period, of which some some musicologists say is the greatest period of rock and roll, which ends in in fact, there are certain days, there are certain years that are picked as the greatest of all time in rock music. 65, 69, 73, 77. And when does this movie take place? It takes place in 1973.
Yeah. And I was even going to add that, there's certainly the issue of, like some of the records that his sister gave him, that they were just a little, like, maybe as much as a year after, in a sense, than what they should have been, a year or two.
Oh, they hadn't come out in 73.
Yeah. I think that was supposed to be, that was the flash. That was the before it. We got to 73. Even that was like 69. I think is when that was supposed to have been, and so there was like some 70, maybe 71 records in the mix there.
Yeah, that's probably true.
When he's younger.
Yeah. And what minute was that, Eric?
Oh boy. About 12, maybe?
Yeah, very early on in the film. Yeah. But I had a similar event in my life. I had an aunt. Not that she was running away to be an airline attendant, but she, decided to give me a stereo and a bunch of records when I was about 11 or 12, and it changed my life.
Yeah, I was lucky enough. I lived in the house with my dad, who had his stereo and allowed me to use it at a younger age of 10 or maybe a little bit younger, not much. There's definitely points where he was showing me, okay, let's clean some records, just make sure these these old vinyl album records.
Yeah, they were rather delicate,
screw up
weren't
his
they?
Turntable too much and so forth.
Yeah, they were delicate. A delicate media that is, I guess, is back in prominence. Vinyl is a lot of people are looking at as a better way to listen to music. I don't know if you guys know this, but this year vinyl took a larger market share in music purchasing than CDs.
I just heard that too. I was, when you started going there, I was like, I hope he's saying that, because if not,
Yeah. So, streaming is now, where most people get their music, but for audiophiles, the warmth of analog, I certainly am a believer in that. Having worked with Neil Young and his people to develop a high definition podcasting, we're the first to put out a high res audio product in podcasting, and Neil's been promoting this for 40 years and saying that digital music, you lose some things. It's a double-edged sword. You also lose the hiss and the pops and cracks that you can get from used vinyl, you don't have that in digital music, but at the same time you are losing some frequencies that are compressed in a digital format that you don't have in an analog format. And so, in other words, you're missing the warmth. Or as Neil likes to say you're missing this feel that there are these overtones and even some frequencies that you may not actually hear, but yeah. you still feel, and you miss that by switching to digital. Mm. Not to turn this into a science experiment.
I've watched those YouTube videos. It's all right. Rolling down Highway
41. All right, so they get off the decrepit bus onto the decrepit plane, as we all know will be, but will prove to be decrepit in future minutes. And then they go to Boston.
Yes, my neck of the woods.
Oh, are you from the Northeast?
I am, and I went to school right outside of Boston. So,
which school did you go to?
I went to Wellesley.
Wellesley. Oh, is that one of the Seven Sisters?
It is.
Oh, very nice, very nice. You are a very educated woman, then.
I think educate there's some of it I'm glad I did, but at the same time, I think the dispersion of the dispersal of education to be more based on experience. I've been like 14 years in my library, and I feel like in some ways I've learned more there than I did in 4 years at school. I definitely learned a lot at school, and I'm glad for it, but there's something about
life experiences.
Overemphasis on college education versus mm-hmm. life experience. I was excited to, when I realized, I was like, yes, I'm the Boston scene.
Mm-hmm. You get to be, so how far out of Boston is Wellesley?
It's 12 miles or 30 to 45 minutes.
There you go. Well, yeah, depending on traffic, right? Depending on the big dig, yeah. right? Then you must have spent a lot of time partying in Boston.
I have seen lots of shows in Boston. I'm not much of a partier. But I think it's really cool how you can feel the history, like the history of music in New England.
Yeah.
My favorite example, there's a small theme park in New Hampshire called Canobie Lake Park, and it is a well-known local history that Aerosmith played some of their first gigs at this
band.
Concert venue mm-hmm. in Canobie Lake.
Yeah.
And a couple years ago, they had an Aerosmith cover band as kind of the anniversary of Aerosmith getting their start at Canobie Lake. Which is just this funny thing to be like, yes, let's celebrate.
Yeah, so let's cheapen it. Let's cheapen the memory by bringing a inferior product in to perform for us.
But at the same time, like one of my years in college, Aerosmith was playing the 4th of July show at the Half Shell for free, and it was just like, yeah, go down the green belt and go see Aerosmith. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, as you do, because it's Boston.
Right. Now, of course, according to another very famous musical rock and roll movie, Boston is really not a music town.
Mm-mm.
You know the movie I speak of, yes?
I think I'm falling short here.
Spinal Tap?
Oh, that's right.
When they get the announcement that Boston is canceled, and they say, it's not really a college town anyway.
Yeah.
Let's see. Okay, so we go from a very quick transition scene of the plane a bus to plane. So obviously they're moving up in the world. They end up in Boston, and then I guess it's the card game is what most of this minute 79 is about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and actually, so while William is walking down the hotel corridor, there's actually this little deleted scene, because you guys do have, hopefully, if you both make it to the third of these 3 minutes mm-hmm. that I have you scheduled for. I did give you the YouTube clip
yep.
for. But here, it's just much smaller things that I don't even think are on YouTube at this point, at least. But so it's just actually a little bit of a clarification of what if you turned up the volume loud enough in watching this minute over and over again, you heard a little bit of about a donkey dick.
I did not hear that.
So definitely missed that.
We just
that.
Get like a darn. We just got like get like a zoomed in.
Is that what that view. Guy in the background yeah. is doing?
Yeah, that's what he's doing. No, not exactly. It's more just one of the guys, and we'll go through who each are. And I just really don't have a good clear take on who's talking when it's not focused, when the camera's not focused on their mouths moving. But one guy's saying donkey dick man, a donkey dick is funny everywhere. Possibly everywhere. I'm pretty sure I heard that at one point in the untitled director's cut. And then the other guy says, yeah, that's funny. You know, so I mean, it's just a very quick thing that you hear a little bit, you hear and see them talking just a little bit better. So I'll go ahead and say who the main one here is that you hear saying that is the Mitch Hedberg character. And hopefully you guys realize that that's who one of these guys was. These in some places it's the sunglasses guy wearing.
You mean Reg?
No, Reg. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. He does have sunglasses. You're right.
Yeah.
But no. Not the other end.
Reg. Reg. They're trying table. To hide Reg completely and utterly for a reason.
So, yeah, at the other end of the table is yeah, but yeah, the Reg character, that's Peter Frampton.
Yeah,
who was actually we saw before. This is the second appearance in the movie. He was down in a hotel lobby at the very very beginning, you know, the first time that William goes with Penny out into the world instead of after they initially met.
Right, and he is the road manager of who?
Yeah. Humble Pie.
And why is that so interesting?
Because that was his old band.
That's right. That was his whole
before
band.
Before he went solo.
Yeah. Do you know, I did not know that until I watched the movie this year and was like, wait a minute. And then I looked it up on IMDb and was like, oh, man, I should have known that. So, and it makes perfect sense. That's a great little Easter egg in there.
But yeah, and then, you know, like you already said, Boston, it's written at the bottom of the screen. Yeah. So, you know, it's one of these very big clue thing instead of just a little external stuff we try to figure out sometimes with just where they are, try to remember when the last time it was written on the screen or what have you. Mm-hmm. But Russell is then Russell is you know, saying welcome to William. I mean, actually, even before that, you know, Dick says, come on in.
Mm-hmm. Very and, lovingly welcomed in by being called the enemy.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And why did they call them the enemy?
Yeah, because I mean, William is supposedly a journalist.
Right.
You know, we don't see him writing a whole lot, but you know, it's going to come. You know, there was certainly the time in the bathtub where he was trying to get some work done, but. And mainly, you know, I've said before, I mean, mainly Jeff Beebe, played by Jason Lee, you know, he seemed to be the big one on calling William the enemy. So this is a Jeffless call out of William as the enemy by both Russell and Dick, pretty much. I'm pretty sure saying that at the same time.
Yeah, I've always kind of wondered about this. I mean, obviously, you know, the press is, you know, the enemy of those that they report on. In certain circumstances, I mean, we've heard a lot of that over the last few years, haven't we? You know, they're just trying to strip back the mythology and tell the truth. And I think from Jason Lee's character's point of view, he's afraid of being exposed because, as we know, a thread in the film is that it's really Billy Crudup's, you know, he's the real talent of Stillwater, and the other guys are all replaceable.
Yeah. Well, and I thought you were even actually going to kind of go towards that, you know, also that Russell is kind of the one that seemed to have the, you know, I don't know about the most to lose, but the juiciest secret, you know, of, you know, if he's the one with the wife or even ex-wife that is now a girlfriend that we hear about a little bit more, I think, in the third minute of what we're doing here. with you two, that, you know, he just, like I said, not necessarily the most to lose, but, you know, it's just most damaging.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's kind of like you're playing a little bit off of, you know, probably the most famous wife situation was, yeah, you know, John Lennon marrying Cynthia, yeah, and, you know, Brian Epstein doing everything he can to keep that out of the press, because he didn't want to mess up, you know, the mop top, you know, girls that, you know, had fallen in love with the four, you know, the Fab Four. So
he wanted their fantasies to continue, mm-hmm, in order to,
yeah,
sell more,
of course,
product.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was what, yeah, they were selling, you know, was, yeah, you know, availability of these young men. And, I don't know. By 73, I'm not sure that would have made, yeah, much of a dent, you know, by exposing, you know, the guitar player who's married is sleeping around. Duh.
Yeah. So, you know, they kind of welcome him in and tell him about, this poker game that they're playing. And,
yeah,
and it's something that,
let's talk about the poker game. So
these roadies and managers have kind of some a way that they fraternize and have fun, and as we'll find out next minute,
so we
do some kind of deceptive, devious things.
So two things: we have four road managers that, yeah, are playing in there. We have Raymond, who is the road manager for the Eagles. Mick.
So that is. The Mitch Hedberg character.
Mitch Hedberg. Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
So the comedian, you know, the many comedians throughout the movie, he's possibly, probably at that point in 2000.
He was like peak.
Yeah, I would say he was probably the biggest, but he was definitely the most like unnoticeable. Unnoticeable. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't recognize him, yeah,
and then that's the thing with the director's cut and the deleted scene. I mean, that's where he actually says this stuff about donkey dicks.
Raymond's with the Eagles, Mick's with the Who. I would assume Red Dog is with Sabbath, since Stillwater is still opening for Sabbath at this point, right?
I looked up Red Dog
because
I didn't,
awesome,
know who he was.
Mm-hmm. And in the credits, legendary Red,
yeah,
Dog.
Legendary Red Dog. So he's actually a roadie for the Allman Brothers, that he was on and off with them for over 30 years. So directly a character, like a real life roadie. And he was also a Vietnam War vet and gave some of his disability checks to the Allman Brothers in the beginning when they were kind of getting going and as part of the crew.
It's kind of like a little what's that angel investor
kind, yeah,
of, right,
yeah,
right, right,
role,
or
I'll be your angel investor, and I'm going to move your heavy shit around.
Well, let's see. There's another famous angel investor in rock and roll, that being Bear Owsley, who I would prefer over Red Dog, because, you know, Red Dog was handing him some of his disability checks. Whereas Owsley was handing the Grateful Dead all of his LSD money.
Ooh, wow.
Well, that's how the Dead ended up with their great sound systems.
Yeah. He was a dealer.
He was a cooker.
Oh, a cooker. Oh, okay. Yeah. Wow.
I'm considered one of the best cookers in all of history. So. All right, there's these four road managers. Why does Russell get to play if this is a road manager's poker party?
Is he playing? I thought he was just sitting
one,
there.
Ah, yes, I did too. But there, when he
hand.
Walks in, Russell's got a card on his forehead.
Uh-oh.
Now
four
with
clubs.
The next round, you're right. He does not play.
Yeah.
So is he in or not in? I can't tell.
Yeah, and that's the, you know, I mean, I think it's pretty casual that, you know, I mean, there's the other guy that's in the back that, you know, yeah, okay, maybe he is the one that's what spurs on, mm-hmm, the Mitch Hedberg character's talk about Donkey Dicks, but yeah, he's back there on the phone and on the bed at a point or something, you know, just hanging out, waiting for, might even be a couple people back there.
By the way, I just noticed Mitch Hedberg is dead.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Died at 37.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It must be drugs. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it was an overdose. Yeah, it was very, very unfortunate. He was a brilliant comedian. I really like his work.
Well, yeah, and gosh, speaking of Donkey Dicks, my two favorite jokes of him involve the letter D.
Yeah.
The Dufresnes and donuts. Mm-hmm. Where are the Dufresnes? But yeah, nonetheless, yeah. I mean, it's a little confusing with Russell there, but you know, I just think it's so casual, and you know, and you know, the one guy sits down. That's the one guy that William meets first, and you know, asks you know about Russell
if he's Russell's there, right?
There, yeah. You know, mm-hmm. And that's played by Devin Corey, just by the way, just you know, not a big point, but that happens to be the actor's name. And there's not a whole lot he's done out
there. Have we checked to see if all of these guys are still alive? Or dead?
Oh, wow. There could be, yeah.
I mean, you know, the Mitch Hedberg story, that's very rock and roll. Yeah, he's the Eagles road manager. And Devin Corey is the Who's road manager. That's what he's credited as.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Devin's, like his last role, and it was uncredited, was in Jarhead in 2005. Yeah. You know? So he certainly hasn't been doing much. I mean, if he did pass away, it's not noted. But we know Peter Frampton's still around. I've seen him on Rick Beato's.
You're a Rick Beato fan, huh? Disappeared. Yeah.
I've watched some of his stuff, yeah.
Yeah, Rick's cool. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so they now are going to play a single game. And this apparently is just between Reg, as played by Peter Frampton, and Dick, right?
Yeah, it really has come down to that. Yeah, the other guys, I mean, every now and then there's a little bit of chatter in the background, which I don't even know if I got mm-hmm. got very well, but in the transcript, what have you, but I supplied to it.
And poor Dick only has a deuce.
Right.
And
it's clearly high card wins.
Yeah. Reg, of course, has a face card. I couldn't figure out if it was a jack, queen, or king. Any one of those cards could have some significance if they were, you know, if it was decided on which one it was. So my first question is, why in the fuck would Dick bet all of that when he knows that Reg has got a face card?
Necessity.
He has to get rid of the girls.
I mean, that's more. We find out more of that in the next minute. So right. Sorry to spoil, but
yeah, and not necessarily the girls, but the one girl in particular.
Yeah,
which I mean, doesn't end up working out anyway. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's you know, Dick maybe as a manager should be fired or something.
he had been fired, he's just demoted to the road manager. Yeah,
just road.
Yeah, yeah, and there is a big difference between those two jobs. Let me tell you.
Now there is a deleted scene, another a little bit longer deleted scene here, and it actually
I am moving in. Oh darn it! Now I see why this takes so long. You have to go to about five different things to look at. Okay,
but it does answer your question about Russell though. The one little part how the deleted scene starts is it adds the two words "which helps" to the end of "so you can play in any condition," which helps. And then one of the other guys, don't know which, adds in about Russell. He says, "We let Russell in because he brought the hash."
Right.
Another guy says, "Easy, easy, the press is here." So, again, treating William very much as the enemy.
Right.
And then Mitch Hedberg, again, he also... This is probably his stronger line compared to the Donkey Dick, actually, is "don't mention me or the Eagles." But then he hands William the can that we've previously seen Red Dog with. I think, I don't know if you guys both noticed that, the can that they're smoking.
Oh, well, I noticed the can. Can't road managers afford a real fucking pipe?
Yeah, right. A little, yeah, right.
That's so a high
DIY,
school.
DIY pipe.
Yeah. Come on, they're in a nice hotel. You can at least go get a good pipe.
And you know, a couple of those guys are folding, saying I'm done and I'm out, you know. And William, you know, the can kind of disappears after he gets handed it, and the camera cuts back and forth a little bit, and it kind of disappears. But so I assume it was going from Mitch Hedberg's character to William, so it should have gone to Dick, but mm-hmm. he's involved in this very important. deal transaction is what it really is going to turn out to be. I think we need mm-hmm. we'll definitely try to get a little more into that next minute.
Yes.
Yeah. But we do get the first or a part of this mm-hmm. what's going to happen, the side proposition to the winner.
The side proposition.
Because that's what it is. That's what's going to be. It's this, you know, two-way street of things being handed back and forth, and supposedly one has more value than the other. And the loser is the one with the lesser value items,
mm-hmm.
is what they're agreeing to. So $50 in the case of Heine, you know, it's not Heine, like in my other podcast, Feels Like Weezer, where we discussed the song Say It Ain't So very early on the Blue Album. And it's pronounced Heine, as it was very much in the 90s. I don't know about before that. but Heineken. Someone's hiney is crowded in my icebox.
No, I don't remember that when I was younger. And I must say, I'm old enough to remember when Heineken was like one of the most exotic beers you could buy.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, that was, boy, it was a special night if somebody pulled out the Heineken.
I enjoyed it in college and you know, compared to other friends that were getting the now so-called, or I'm pretty sure then we called it Natty Light, you know, the piss water.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Like Coors Light and Bud Light and Miller Light. And yeah, that was the American beers. And then the only other exotic beers were, you know, St. Pauli Girl and Heineken. And then we had some, I think Dos Equis was coming into play. And then I remember the first time I had a Qingdao from China. That was like, boy, that was exotic.
But here on Beer Talk, I think we're coming to a close. Love it. I haven't had a beer for months and months now.
Yeah, I'm not much of a beer guy myself. I'm a wine guy.
I'm a little... Just a little more of a social drinker. I mean, I enjoy them, but just do it mainly socially.
It's got to be hot and outside for me to enjoy a beer. Otherwise, I prefer my wine.
Yeah. Do either of you have any more notes for this minute?
No, I feel like I'm going to rush myself and get into the next minute because that's where the juicy stuff happens. But you know, this minute is I might ask Kendra what did you think of masculine types all getting together doing their thing.
Femaleless minute.
Yes.
You know, I will save all those thoughts until the next minute because I've got a lot of thoughts.
Yeah, I figured you might. Boy, were those different times, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Now, you know, I like, you know, that, you know, they're moving up. Obviously, that's this, you know, what the plane signifies. You know, mm-hmm. they're now in Boston, you know, a real music town. You know, they're probably going to have, thinking they're going to have a great show. I find it interesting that, they're humanizing Russell by putting him in with the, you know, the average guys, you know, the worker bees, and he can hang with them. Whereas, you know, you would never see Jason Lee's character do that. Of course not. He's above it all, right? So that's kind of cool.
I think Russell doesn't look comfortable, though. There's definitely an unease as much, I think, especially realizing what Dick is doing, and like, as the scene progresses, the more uncomfortable he looks. And he definitely is like not as relaxed as like Red Dog.
Oh, well, here's a question. Did Russell put Dick up to getting rid of the girls?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's
why he's uncomfortable. It's like, oh, here's that moment we talked about. Here's where it's going to go down.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely could be the case. I mean, I'm sure he had something to do with it, especially because it's his ex-wife slash girlfriend that is the reason he needs to get rid of Penny.
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, the fact that he's there in general and he didn't just be like, go do this thing for me, it is good, but it's still like, I'm glad he looks uncomfortable about being there because, like, yeah, what he's doing is not great.
No. Obviously what's going to happen in the next minute is not great, and certainly doesn't play very well in 2020. That's for sure.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Wow. But
just one of a list of things that
I've been on for
well.
Other fun things in this movie before.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Now we're all uncomfortable. You know, the simplicity of the card game, obviously able to be played under any condition. You know, that makes sense. I do wonder who's the guy in the background and what is his purpose? I guess we'll never know.
Sure seems like it. Yeah, I mean, you know, and really, like I think I said, I think there's actually a couple people even know, back there. You know, there's another person on that bed. I'm awfully sure.
And then there's kind of one person standing up kind of in the corner in front of the window,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's who I was talking about. The guy in the background standing up in the window. It's like, what is he doing?
Yeah, there's at least one person on the bed, too.
Oh, the stories that those guys can tell.
So Christian, since I generally just take care of this the first time people are on the episode or on an episode, and when they're on a couple times at least, we'd like to have you rank from favorite to least, or vice versa, the four bands that are most commonly believed to make up the band Stillwater.
Yeah, and the four bands are Allman Brothers. I mean, that's obvious. I say Zeppelin for two reasons. One, because Fever Dog, which is the most prominent song that's played in the movie, which they do a great job of, very Zeppelin-esque. By the way, all written by Nancy Wilson, who was a big Zeppelin fanatic herself. And, you know, you can say Heart sounds a lot like Zeppelin, especially the early stuff.
And with Peter Frampton for at least a couple of the songs as well.
Yeah, he was involved in the writing. So. That's right. Leonard Skinner, was a third, and the Eagles being the fourth. Right. Those are the four bands. Yeah. Right.
And that's your order?
No, hell no. Yeah. That's not my order.
So
I have to rank them, and what is the criteria for ranking?
Just your personal preference.
My personal favorites?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Man.
Yeah, you don't have to think about are they actually really good?
Uh-huh.
Just what, how do you respond at this time? At this time.
Okay. I would put Leonard Skinner at the bottom. And nothing against Skinner. I like Skinner. I've played some of their songs. There's a real genius to them. It's not that I dislike them, but they didn't float my boat as much as the Allman Brothers did. And I think I look at those two bands as similar.
Yeah, they're the most of a pair.
Yeah, Southern rock, that sort of stuff. Yeah. And, you know, I was able to see both bands, and I've seen the Allman Brothers a million times because I just thought they were that great. I hate to say this, but I think I'm going to put the Allman Brothers at the top. I'd put the Eagles third, because I love their harmony. The harmonies, especially with Randy Meisner and Timothy B. Schmidt's high voice on the top. You know, their songwriting, say what you want. And I know, since we've already brought up the Big Lebowski, there's the famous saying of, I hate the Eagles, get out of my cab. And I think that is unworthy. I know a lot of people complain about the Eagles because they were one of the most professional acts. And what that means is that they were put together professionally. These weren't chums that said, let's make a band. You know, everybody was put into that, that band for a very specific reason. And they wrote, you know, out of all of them, you know, they wrote the most hits. Okay. Zeppelin would be second, you know, probably the most influential of the four bands, because let's face it, is there anybody in the 80s that plays hard rock that is not influenced by Zeppelin? No. They all sound like Zeppelin when you get right down to it. So, but for me personally, just, I never did get to see, Zeppelin live. Boy, the Allman Brothers, every time I saw them, I left just astounded on how good they were and just where they could take the music. You know, I mentioned the Grateful Dead earlier with the Bear Owsley making the acid and getting them started. And I've seen the Grateful Dead a million times as well. And the Allman Brothers are like the Grateful Dead who can play, you know, that are just the musicianship is like, oh my
God. It's up a notch.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong. I love the Dead. I love what they do. Yeah. And I love being in there in that audience and all that. So from the bottom, Leonard Skinner, Eagles, Zeppelin, and of course the Allman Brothers.
Yeah. Well, two things I'd like to ask because I really do, you know, I mean, you're a musician. I mean, you do this podcasting stuff too, which we'll get to in a moment, I think, but, you know, you're a musician and you mentioned the Dead I've always kind of got the take and listened enough, I think, to Jerry. I mean, Jerry, he was kind of maybe close to being on the same level as, say, the other playing Allman Brothers. Performers.
Jerry,
but it's the rest of the band of the Dead.
Yeah. I mean, I would put
that's maybe the notch down.
Yeah, Jerry is, you know, one of the most beautifully fluid guitar players ever. Yeah. I mean, to me, Jerry is like he's like listening to a stream rolling over rock. You know, it's just this beautiful, natural sound. There's not a lot of flash, and when he does flash, you know, the audience gets excited, you know. so there's that. I put Phil up there as a world-class musician. You know, Phil was the only really trained musician in the band. Bobby, you know, had to work, and let's face it, he was brought in to be the face of the band. He was the good looking one. Neither of the drummers, Mickey has done a lot, percussion wise and, you know, is a good percussionist, has opened a lot of doors with using his platform. And then the keyboard players, it started off with Pigpen, who was actually a pretty damn good blues singer and pianist and harp player. And of course, you know, they lost him young. I preferred the 80s Brent Midland period. That's my favorite. And he was a pretty world-class musician. Today, let's face it, John Mayer, he's a world-class guitar player. And O'Teal Burbidge, who's now the bass player, he's world-class. So the what is called Dead & Company today is pretty good. But, you know, the Allman Brothers, with and without Duane, And I, of course, I never got to see them with Dwayne, but I've heard plenty. And by the way, O.T.L. Burbridge was the bass player for the Allman Brothers for 30 years before moving over to Dead & Company after the Allman Brothers called it quits. I think that just that band consistently every night, you know, musically, you know, were just, it was almost like if Yes played blues based Southern rock.
Okay.
You know, yeah. That's the way the Allman Brothers were for me. I mean, I my head would explode every time I'd see those guys, just shaking my head and want to cry because I could never be that good. Whereas, you know, the Grateful Dead, it's a little more accessible, might be a way to put it. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's my long winded answer.
Yeah. Well, and then maybe something that, yeah, you could be shorter on maybe, but you can go on a little bit longer if you want to. My second question was more about back with the Eagles. You mentioned like put together. So, I mean, was that a manager? I'm just not thinking of who that is.
No, it wasn't. I have to think back in the beginning of the Eagles. I think it was David Geffen who kind of helped put them together.
Okay.
I mean, let's face it that Glenn Frey and, you know, all these guys hung out at the Troubadour in L.A. Okay. These were Laurel Canyon people, right? And, Glenn Frey, who came from Detroit, brought a certain rougher musicality, you know, was an acolyte of Bob Seger, and came out to LA to make it. Don Henley, from Texas, brought a completely different set of skills, and musical feel. And those two are the backbone of the Eagles. And it's their professional relationship that drives everything else. They realized, you know, when they're coming together in the early 70s, you know, they start off in Linda Ronstadt's backing band. They realize that, you know, they've got something and they think that they can fit this new corporatized professional music world that is going to occur in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And so they intentionally go, okay, well, who's the best guy for this? Well, they picked Bernie Ledden to come in because he was a multi-instrumentalist and he could sing. And then they brought Randy Meisner, who they stole from the Burrito Brothers, who, you know, had this incredible, you know, falsetto that could sit on top of everything and create this 3 or 4 or 5 part harmonies that, you know, were on the level of the Beach Boys, you know, or the Everly Brothers, you know, sort of thing. So they were picked very specifically to fit those niches. And the proof of that is that as they switched, and they, you know, they got rid of Bernie Ledden, Bernie didn't want to go into a more harder rock vein, but Frey and Henley knew that that's the way music was going. So, you know, they brought in Joe Walsh and, I forget his name that they fired not too long ago. Oh, actually about 20 years ago. But and that brought a little bit harder rock scene to fit into what was going on professionally out there. And then the obvious is that when Randy Meisner left, they stole the next bass player from Poco. It was Poco is where the two bass players came from. And that was Timothy B. Schmidt, who sounded exactly like Randy Meisner. So, you know, kept that quality of voice that they were looking for out there. So it's just the thought process and the knock on the Eagles is that it was all done in service of the mighty dollar. You know, there's something to be said about that and how they went about their songwriting. But I mean, is that any different than Tin Pan Alley, which is, you know, that's what those guys were doing in the eras before. You know, it was all about, you know, creating the best pop song to hit the charts at the right moment to make as much bank as possible. Mm-hmm. And I'll leave it right there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a little bit of the rock and roll archaeology, you know, stuff that we're getting a little taste of here.
Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah, that's what I do for a living.
Yeah. Let's get back to that in a minute and actually have Condra talk about what she does and give some plugs.
Sure. If people want to find me on the internet, I co-host a show, a Movies by Minute podcast with my brother. We're called the Amateur Nerds. Right now we are on our third season where we are covering High School Musical.
Yeah, so everyone should definitely go check that out. Check out all three of their projects that they've done before and one currently going. Mm-hmm. Appreciate Condra coming on again. We'll be back next minute, of course, too.
Yeah.
But before we get to that part, so let's hear just a little bit more from Christian. Back about the good old Pantheon Podcast Network, and you can go for your main show or
let's talk about rock and roll archaeology. Anybody can go to the pantheonpodcast.com and check out all of our offerings out there. We've got almost 70 shows now on the network, all music related, and a lot of cross pollination that goes on there. If you like one, you'll probably like three or four or five out there. But so this all started 5 years ago when I created a show called Rock and Roll Archaeology, which is a chronological telling of the music, the history of the music of the late 20th century. So we actually start post-World War II and show how music, culture, and technology wove together to create this feedback loop that you know, created what I happen to think is some of the best music that's ever been written and will stand the test of time. It already has stood the test of 70 years. That's pretty huge. And, you know, I think we'll look back on this era 500 years from now and say, wow, this was a really special moment in music. And the reason why is because of, you know, how the culture, the music, and the technology all kind of showed up at the same time. The music commented on the times. The times affected the music. The technology that started mostly out of World War II, you know, went into commercial endeavors. The recording industry and the live music industry both benefited from this technological explosion of the late 20th century. And we got, you know, concerts and recordings that just got better and better as we went along.
Yeah, and the drugs maybe kind of helped a little bit too, but hurt as well.
Certain drugs definitely helped. Drugs definitely hurt. You know, it's not just that. It's you know, societal changes. You know, the pluralistic society, the fact that you know, we had an educated populace, the baby booms that had risen to prominence and had given a place at the table. The teenager became a thing, and I don't mean there weren't teenagers before, because there's always been teenagers, but there wasn't
they're calling them that.
Yeah, there wasn't a consumer group known as teenagers.
They are a demographic
exactly
that is important too.
Yeah, and that's people, you know, that's them. Late. That's starts with the baby boomers and moves into Generation X. And so for at least two generations, if not two and a half, you know, this music was, you know, the touchstone. It was the currency of the day. It was how the tribes were made. I don't think that's the case now. I think there are other things. And to be honest with you, you know, music's been replaced by social media and gaming as the primary touchstones of today's youth, but we have fun exploring the human condition through the music of the late 20th century.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Christian, for coming on first time. And we should have you back the next couple minutes.
Yeah.
And Conjure 2, hopefully. At least the next one here.
Mm-hmm. If she can put up with me for another two episodes.
Yeah. And we definitely get into a little diciness. With the girls, the Band-Aids, and Penny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In this poker game. So thank you both so much. The one thing I'll say real quick is for anyone trying that would like to just personally, privately message me, you can reach me at almostfamousminute@gmail.com. So otherwise, we're just all over the place, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and find us wherever, and definitely at pantheonpodcast.com. Next time will be minute 80. This was 79, and we'll see you then. Until then, it's all happening.
It's all happening.
I am a golden god! Yeah! Yes,
you are! And I was born in the backseat of a Greyhound bus, rolling down Highway 41.
You know the queen of hearts is always your best bet.